Our next speaker is joined the American Constitution Society in 2009 and serves as its president today. Her name is Caroline Fredrickson. She helped grow the American Constitution Society to more than 40 lawyer chapters across the country, student chapters in nearly every law school in the United States, and thousands of members throughout the nation. She's an eloquent spokesperson for the progressive movement on civil and human rights, judicial nominations, and the importance of the courts in America, marriage equality, voting rights, and the role of money in politics. She's been widely published on a range of legal and constitutional issues and is a frequent guest on many television and radio shows, including a notable and well-covered appearance on Fox News' O'Reilly Factor, in which she bravely defended the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act in that parallel universe at Fox News. Caroline is the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over, and there are copies available in a merchandise booth right behind me. Before serving at the American Constitution Society, she served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office and as general counsel and legal director of NARAL Pro-Choice America. Please join me in welcoming Caroline Fredrickson.
Hi. It's so great to be here in Madison. You know, I'm coming from Washington, and it is such a relief to get out of there. So thanks, all of you, for being the Madison that I love. I grew up not too far from here to the south, outside of Chicago, and spent a lot of time in Wisconsin, so it's nice to be back here among friends. So I want to thank everybody who's put this wonderful festival together. It's really a testament to the vibrancy of the progressive community here and to your commitment to making this world and our country a better place. So thanks, all of you, for everything you've done and what I know you're going to do in the days to come. When I was applying to college, and some of you in the audience, maybe in that group that are thinking about that, I had this story in mind that I wanted to write about for my essays, and I had this great-grandmother, and her name was Matilda Olofsson. And as you might guess, I'm at least partially Swedish. And I'd heard this story about her. She was this brave, brave young woman. When she was just 18 years old, she decided to leave her family. Her mother had died. Her siblings had died. It was a time when Sweden was a desperately poor country, and her father told her there was no future for her. She got on a boat. She was in steerage. Those of you who've seen Titanic, you know what that is. She went to Boston, and she became a scullery maid, which is the lowest of the low jobs in the kitchen, where she was scrubbing the scraps off the plates and often actually having to eat them because that was all she was given from the people who hired her. She didn't have any legal rights. She was subject to all sorts of abuses. Now, I thought at the time in high school that was kind of this romantic story and how her life had changed and everything got better. And, you know, again, for those of you sort of in my age group at the time, you know, my family was watching Upstairs, Downstairs. It kind of seemed like my family's version of the downstairs part. And it really seemed like it was of a long time ago. But, you know, I started being really interested in issues. I'm a labor lawyer originally, and I do employment discrimination issues. And I started thinking about, you know, what's the state of play for workers like that today and doing some research. And I happen to say I was really embarrassed in some ways because as much time as I've spent looking at legal issues in this in the world of employment, I didn't realize how little had changed for women in the kinds of jobs that Matilda did over 100 years ago. So I thought, you know what, this is just like, we have Downton Abbey now, and then we had Upstairs, Downstairs when I was a kid, and it's pretty much the same story, right? Nothing has changed. So I found Sonia Suarez. She has the life that my grandmother had, my great-grandmother had, at the end of the 19th century. She lives in Boston. She's a domestic worker. She suffered from wage theft. Her employers wouldn't let her go to a doctor when she was sick. She actually was not entitled to get overtime pay when they made her work well over 8 hours a week, often over 10, 12, 14 hours a day. She was subject to sexual harassment and physical abuse. And so what really came to shock me, and the more I did research, was to find out that for certain domestic workers and workers in other jobs dominated by women, they have very few rights and almost as few as those like Matilda did over 100 years ago. So we all know, you know, we know that during the New Deal, there were a lot of changes made to our laws involving workers' rights. But what a lot of people don't know is how many people were actually left out, and explicitly left out of those laws. The pervasive ideas about race, women, and work played such an enormous role in shaping and limiting what kind of work would actually be considered worthy of the protection of the laws. And so, you know, President Roosevelt, he did a lot of wonderful things. But one of the things that he felt that he had to do during the New Deal was he had to bargain with the Dixiecrats. And their bargain was this: we'll give you these laws, we'll give you a minimum wage and overtime, the right to organize a union, Social Security, but we're not going to give it to the black people. I mean, and I say this in a way, it sounds extreme, but this is exactly the narrative and what they were saying. And in fact, there was a senator, his name was Cotton, his nickname was Cotton, and as you might think, Cotton is a pretty bad, has a pretty bad role in this story I'm telling you. His nickname was Cotton Ed Smith, and he complained during the adoption of these laws. He said, you know, it's so terrible. First, we adopt a law against lynching. Then you adopt a law that basically, you know, a rule of the Democratic Convention that took away the two-thirds rule that the Southern Democrats had over who got to be the nominees. And then he says, what was really unconscionable, though, he says, I will not attempt to use the proper adjective to designate, in my opinion, what this bill, and in this time he's talking about the bill that set up the minimum wage and overtime, you know, something we think was a great law, right? He says, any man on this floor who has sense enough to read the English language knows that the main object of this bill is by human legislation to overcome the splendid gifts of God to the South. Okay, so you know what that, it's pretty obvious. What he's saying is we believe that the plantation system that really didn't go away after the Civil War should be continued, and we're not going to let the law make a difference. And so, particularly with women's work, the domestic workers and the farm workers were explicitly excluded from that whole set of laws, as well as a number of other workers that types that were specifically dominated by women and people of color. And in fact, domestic labor in particular was called at the time niggers' work. So we moved on after that to become more subtle in how we left out low-wage women, and particularly women of color, from our protective laws. Because what we ended up doing was using other formalities, like the size of a business. Small businesses could be discriminatory, weren't subject to the variety of laws that protected other workers. It all seemed neutral, but in fact, it wasn't. And so when you think about the Civil Rights Act of 1964, again, an incredibly important move forward. But we think, you know, people will tell you the small business exclusion in the Civil Rights Act was somehow because it was a burden not to let small business discriminate. Well, that's in fact what they were saying very explicitly on the record, was that there was a need to protect the personal relationships that existed in such firms. And there was another. So the other guy was nicknamed Cotton. This guy was actually a Senator Cotton. And you might know there's a Senator Cotton in the Senate right now. And unfortunately, there's too much similarity. This Senator Cotton, during the consideration of the Civil Rights Act in 1964, said, you know, when a small businessman selects an employee, he comes very close to selecting a partner. When he selects a partner, he comes dangerously close to the situation he faces when he selects a wife. So, you know, those of you, you know, I'm a legal person, so I can tell you that until several years after the consideration of the Civil Rights Act, states could actually still forbid people of different races from marrying each other. That's what he's talking about. He's like, we employers should be able to have the same rules, and we shouldn't have to hire people of a different race. So the other piece that really undermines the protective labor laws that I think many of us take for granted is that so many workers now, and particularly low-wage workers and women of color, have been designated as contractors, independent contractors. And many of us hear this now, that the story of the moment has been Uber. All right? But long before there was an app, there were low-wage women who were cleaning toilets in office buildings who were called independent contractors and were not protected against discrimination, were not provided overtime or a minimum wage, have been excluded from all of those laws because independent contractors are not employees, and if they're not employees, they don't get those rights. So let me just say, I kind of got interested in digging into this research about who was left out, because you know what, leaning in is all fine, but what we need is structural help, not self-help. So that's why I wrote my book, Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over, which shows that in reality, even our basic labor and safety net protections that we assume are available for everyone are denied the most vulnerable workers, primarily women and particularly women of color. So I'm just going to talk about a few of the issues. I think, you know, we all know that women make less than men. And for women of color, it's particularly significant. African American women make only 71% of what men make, and Latinas only 56%. But what we often fail to do is to think about why that is. And one big reason is that women are the backbone of the low-wage workforce. They are two-thirds of minimum wage workers, and they're three-fourths of those who earn the sub-minimum wage paid to tipped employees, which is at the federal level $2.13. And let me ask you, is that not unconscionable to pay people $2.13 an hour? Three-quarters of those people are women, mostly low-wage women of color. And I would have to say that here in Wisconsin, you're not doing too much better because your tipped wage is $2.33. And then, of course, the women who are not protected at all against discrimination are discriminated against in a whole variety of ways. As I mentioned, the laws don't protect women who are independent contractors. They don't protect women who are in small businesses. And that results in lower pay because guess what? You can't bring a lawsuit for discrimination if you're not protected by the law. So let me just mention a couple of other areas that are really significant for women workers and where we have a lot of work to do. So wages are important, but so are hours. Women in particular, but all workers right now, are suffering from a variety of either they're been worked too much, or they're being worked too little, or they're being worked at times that they're not told about in advance. Their schedules are so variable. They have no advance notice. So this has had a real impact on women, especially mothers. And so for that group of people I mentioned are not protected by our minimum wage and overtime rule, guess what? Who are you going to ask to work a lot of hours? It's going to be the people you don't have to pay overtime to. So when you find domestic workers, as I mentioned, only recently under President Obama has he helped to address one part of this problem, which is to put them back under the minimum wage and overtime law. But until this year, domestic workers, nannies, home care aides, the people who are making sure that older people have care every day, not entitled to overtime pay, which resulted in hours that were, once again, I will use the word unconscionable, because these women were practically worked to death for $10 an hour if they were lucky. Now, the other thing is obviously part-time workers. A lot of workers have been pushed into part-time jobs, work two or three jobs. You know, not to beat a dead horse here, but the group that's most likely to be working more than two jobs are women with children. Hard life, that is. So let me just mention one other issue in the scheduling arena, which I think some of you might be familiar with. But there's, you know, these clever people who are developing the algorithms for companies have come up with this idea that, like, well, can't we, like, have our workers function just like widgets? You know, if we're making a car, don't we order parts for the car just as we need them? So can't we do that with workers? Let's not have regular schedules. Let's have them call in every day. Let's make it up as we go along. So they've adopted these schedules that they like to call just-in-time or on-demand schedules, but maybe we should call them jerk-the-worker-around schedule, where you have people who have to call in literally every single day, find out if they've got a shift or not. Now, again, imagine, you know, you're the person who's like the single parent. You got to deal with childcare. You might have to pay a rent. You maybe buy groceries and deal with childcare costs. If you don't know if you have a work day, you don't know if you need to get a sitter. You don't know if you're going to have the money at the end of the week to pay your landlord to stay in your apartment. There was recently, you know, this story about, you know, there's a lot of companies that have done this that particularly employ women because it's been a particular use in the restaurant industry and the retail industry. And Victoria's Secret was one of those companies, and I thought, oh, give me a break, right? So you get to make the workers who work at Victoria's Secret call in every day to find out, like, thongs are up today, we need more workers. You know, sorry, bras aren't selling, you don't need to come in. I mean, like, give me a break. There are places, though, that have started to get a handle on this. And I'll get to that. I did just want to mention, though, that childcare is another issue that's obviously of significance. Now, that's just for women. Women tend to bear the brunt. But it's a family issue. And, you know, this is a message of hope and also of embarrassment for the United States. But people may not know this. So we have very little in the way of family leave. We have very little in the way of childcare. But there was a time, and this may be, especially for younger people, and this was actually even surprising for me because I didn't have any memory of this, but during the Nixon administration, Congress passed universal childcare. Okay, none of you may believe this. Some of you may remember it. But it's true. Congress could actually do things that were good. So it's almost none of us remember time like that, but it's true. They passed legislation for childcare. Wow, I mean, that's kind of an incredible thing. But it was during the Nixon administration. It was also right after the groups that defeated the ERA were celebrating. So they were still around. And some of you may, you know, recall Phyllis Schlafly, who is recently deceased, I understand. Yeah, exactly. Well, so Phyllis, she organized a group that combated this childcare, and there was a group, it was called the 4 W's or the 3 W's of women who want to be women. Because, God, you know, real women don't want childcare, right? Because, I don't know. But they were able to be successful. They rallied the same people who fought the ERA to attack this bill. Now, it already passed Congress. They got President Nixon to veto it. And here's, you know, what Phyllis Schlafly said was, we realized that if we didn't get out and defend our values, this little feminist pressure group, I guess that was Congress, you know, because they passed this law, that this little feminist pressure group was going to end up changing our schools, our laws, our textbooks, our constitution, our military, everything, and end up taking our husbands' jobs away. You know, the world is coming to an end. We have childcare in America. Well, sadly, their vision of America with this, their idea of the perfect family, which was a white one, daddy at work, mommy at home, was one that they thought they could protect by getting rid of childcare. And what they did was they robbed everybody in America of something that could have done an enormous, enormous amount of good. So I want to, you know, take this to in a slightly different direction before I conclude, but just to say, these issues are so critical. And there is so much to be done. Madison, I know, has been making efforts around paid sick days and other initiatives. States and localities have been fighting. When Congress has been able to do nothing to improve family leave and childcare, has not done anything to address the loopholes in our civil rights protections or in our minimum wage and overtime laws, there have been states and localities that have done something about it. They have raised the minimum wage. They have created new models for workers to organize, even if they're not protected by the National Labor Relations Act. They have given workers more control over their schedules. Of course, this has led to a backlash. And I just want to commend, I don't know if any of my friends from the Center for Media and Democracy are here, but they've put a big spotlight on the group ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is an awful organization. It has been in the lead of fighting for terrible legislation at the state and local level from stand your ground laws to requirements for photo IDs for voting. They drafted, Alec, the very first sick leave preemption bill here in Wisconsin. So Wisconsin had sick pay protection, which is not a federal right. States have done it, or localities on their own. Alec came in and preempted. So preemption is a big issue where they're taking away the rights of localities like Madison to do better than your state might do, to raise your own minimum wage. They've done this across the country. But I'm going to go to the courts because that's what I do. My organization fights for fair courts and good judges. And I just want to say, when they don't win their preemption fights, they go to the courts. So even when we progressives are successful in getting the minimum wage increased or getting sick leave, they come at it from the court side. And what's the danger is that we have a system in many states and here in Wisconsin where judges are for sale. And we and my organization have done a number of studies, which is not, they're not going to surprise you, but they're just the data behind what you already know, is that dollars have an impact and money talks, and judges rule in ways that reflect the people who are giving them money in a whole variety of areas, unfortunately. Outcomes are determined by contributions. So I want to just tell you that if we, all of us, we care about progressive outcomes, and we obviously, all the issues I've talked about are very central, I think, to the progressive vision of what a just America looks like. But we got to care just as much about our court system, because we can win in the legislature, we can get a good governor or a president, but if the courts are going to take us down, we're going to have nothing to show for it at the end of the day. So even though there may be a system where money is talking, we can combat it by being active, by paying attention, and making sure that we have the judges in place that we need. So I want to bring this back. So I started this story with Matilda Olofsson and Sonia Suarez. And I was just thinking, there's another Sonia I wanted to mention to you because she kind of wraps this story up. But there's a Sonia Sotomayor on the federal Supreme Court. We need judges. We need to care about the judges, because it's judges like Sonia Sotomayor and not Antonin Scalia who are going to make sure that we have the rights that we believe are in the Constitution, who understand the Constitution is meant to protect fundamental rights and liberties and not property and not those in power. It's a document that was meant to create a fair and just America. So I want to say that I am hopeful. I want to go back to that child care bill. Congress actually passed universal child care legislation. Don't let anybody tell you that we can't get that done again. But we need to have a robust and fair system at every level. And I'm going to ask all of you, you know, make sure, you know, we're not a nonpartisan organization, so I'm not endorsing any candidate. But I just want to make you sure that as you look at your court system here in Wisconsin, and as you look at your elected officials, you make sure that they care about the courts, and they're making sure that you have a good system that's going to protect these rights that we're fighting for. Because women like Sonia Suarez need the protections that we're going to try and get in legislation. And I want to do this in memory of Matilda Olofsson, who I wish had had the rights that we're all fighting for 100 years ago. So thank you very much. It was great to be here and enjoy the day with you. Thank you.
You can get a copy of Caroline Frederickson's book, Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over, at the Progressive Magazine's table right behind the stage. And you can meet our associate editor, Bill Leaders, who's there. Get a copy of the book, chat with Bill.